Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+. To jest podcast System Trader, odcinek 29. Gary Antonacci to gość, którego mam zaszczyt i honor wam dziś zaprezentować. Bez cienia przesady. Uważam jego pracę za przełom w długoterminowym inwestowaniu na rynkach kapitałowych. Zapraszam.
Interesujesz się inwestowaniem na rynkach kapitałowych? Szukasz swojego sposobu na oszczędzanie i pomnażanie pieniędzy? Zastanawiasz się, jak postawić swoje pierwsze kroki na giełdzie? Ponadto fakty, mity, wywiady i ciekawostki ze świata finansów. To i wiele więcej usłyszysz w podcaście System Trader. Zaprasza Jacek Lempart.
Wyobraź sobie, że spędzasz dosłownie zaledwie kilka minut w miesiącu, aby zarządzać swoją długoterminową inwestycją. Wszystko, co robisz, oparte jest na kilku prostych i logicznych instrukcjach. Płyniesz z rynkiem, reagujesz na jego ruchy, ale nie walczysz z nim, ani nie starasz się wyprzedzać jego zachowań. Nie ma miejsca na uznaniowe decyzje, zgadywanie czy prognozowanie czegokolwiek w odniesieniu do tego, co rynek może zrobić bądź nie. Nie musisz czytać kolejnych bezwartościowych w większości komentarzy analityków, prognostów i szarlatanów. Nie musisz rozważać tysięcy zmiennych, które mogą wpłynąć bądź nie na zachowanie rynku. Wszystkie twoje decyzje transakcyjne wynikają z fenomenu, który obserwowany jest na rynkach od wieków. I od wieków pozwala on regularnie pobijać rynki. Wielu dorobiło się dzięki jego istnieniu ogromnych fortun. U podstaw tej rynkowej anomalii leży ludzka natura, co daje niemal pewność, że nie przestanie ona występować z dnia na dzień. Brzmi jak kolejne tanie oszustwo, jak prymitywna próba sprzedawania marzeń, których w świecie finansowym jest całe mnóstwo? Zdecydowanie powinien każdy z nas wszystko samodzielnie weryfikować, nie wierzyć nikomu na słowo. Cóż, dziwnym trafem, jeśli idzie o wybór nowej lodówki czy telewizora, jesteśmy skłonni spędzić na decyzję o kupnie nawet tygodnie czy wręcz miesiące. Gdy zaś idzie o podejmowanie decyzji na rynkach kapitałowych, mamy skłonność do bycia kompletnymi ignorantami, nie wykazującymi nawet minimum racjonalności. Ale prawdą jest, że opisany przed chwilą scenariusz prostej strategii faktycznie istnieje i jest możliwy do zastosowania w praktyce przez większość z nas. Stoi za nią bardzo wiele mocnych argumentów, tak statystycznych, jak i empirycznych. Najtęższe głowy ze świata nauk ekonomicznych, łącznie z noblistami, potwierdzają fakt istnienia anomalii stojącej za taką strategią. O czym mowa? Aberracja ta ma wiele określeń i odmian, ale w praktyce najczęściej określana jest mianem momentum lub impetu cen. Niestety, największą trudnością w stosowaniu takiej strategii jesteśmy my sami, a ściślej rzecz ujmując, nasza psychika, z której to zaś wynika brak konsekwencji działania i dyscypliny. Trudność ta jest dużo większa niż sądzimy. Jak ulał pasują tu słowa Warrena Buffetta, który podobno powiedział kiedyś, że inwestowanie jest proste, ale nie jest łatwe. W tym odcinku usłyszysz krótką historię współczesnych finansów, jako wstęp do wypracowania kontekstu, w którym znajdują się modele oparte na momentum. Gary Antonacci w ostatnich kilku latach wniósł do świata inwestycji więcej niż całe zastępy naukowców na uniwersytetach ekonomicznych. Sam porzucił karierę naukową w latach 70. XX wieku, aby nie walczyć z wiatrakami w świecie zdominowanym przez teorie ekonomiczne, mówiące o tym, że na rynkach kapitałowych nie można regularnie zarabiać. Jest absolwentem Harvarda i Berkeley, ale przede wszystkim jest praktykiem, który na rynkach kapitałowych spędził niemal pół wieku, pracując z najlepszymi traderami i inwestorami świata, jak chociażby Paulem Tudorem Jonesem. Naukowcy zdawali się tkwić przez wiele dekad w letargu, jeśli idzie o fenomen momentum. Zajęci za to pogonią usilnego unaukowiania teorii ekonomicznych. I musieli w pewnym momencie przełknąć gorzką pigułkę z noblistą i piewcą efektywnych rynków Eugene Fama na czele, uznając w końcu momentum jako najważniejszą anomalię rynków kapitałowych, tak zwane premier anomaly. Dziś momentum jest szeroko opisywane przez świat naukowy, ale wciąż mocno niedoceniane przez wielu inwestorów. Gary nie odkrył niczego nowego, ale przede wszystkim połączył znane od wieków cegiełki w bardzo sensowną całość. dokonując swoistego przełomu. Za swój wkład w świecie inwestycji wygrał odpowiednio pierwsze w 2012 roku i drugie w 2011 roku miejsce w prestiżowym konkursie Adolfa Wagnera. Odcinek ten jest w języku angielskim, ale obiecuję wszystkim zainteresowanym, że materiał ten nie tylko pojawi się w języku polskim, co może nieco potrwać, ale że całą metodologię będę sukcesywnie opisywał i przybliżał na łamach mojego bloga. Będzie to działo się wolno, bo kładę nacisk na jakość i uczciwość, a nie ilość prezentowanego materiału. Osobiście zainteresowałem się pracami Garego, szukając sposobu na własne długoterminowe inwestycje emerytalne w ramach konta IKE i IKZE. Większość moich inwestycji krótkoterminowych jest w pełni zalgorytmizowana i zautomatyzowana. Szukałem czegoś podobnego dla portfeli emerytalnych, ale w wydaniu długoterminowym i z uwzględnieniem ograniczeń, jakie niesie ze sobą taki portfel. Ten odcinek to zaledwie zapowiedź tego, nad czym pracuję, a z czym będę starał się z Wami sukcesywnie dzielić. Mam ambicje, aby przybliżyć wielu z Was, że na rynkach kapitałowych można poruszać się w sposób zobiektywizowany, zorganizowany, w duchu Mickiewiczowskiego, szkiełka i oka, a co najważniejsze, regularnie wypracowywać zyski. Tymczasem zapraszam do wywiadu. Hello, Gary, and welcome to my podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I'm very glad to have you here today. I have prepared an extensive list of very interesting topics to be discussed today. You're very well known in the industry. However, could you please share with us some short background about yourself, especially in the context of the financial markets?
I got started in 1974 in the investment area right out of college. I worked for Merrill Lynch and Smith Barney for a few years, and then went on and got an MBA degree from the Harvard Business School, and started managing money part-time while I was in business school, never had to go out and find a job. I've always been a professional money manager or researcher ever since.
Okay, that's very interesting. So basically, when you started in in the 70s, then you stopped working for the financial sector, so to speak, in the 80s?
I've continued from the 70s continuously. I had a few breaks along the way where I just did a few other things temporarily, but I've always kept a pulse on what was going on in the markets and with respect to market research.
Okay, I understand. I paid attention to the fact that you've done some cool things in the past. For example, you were, I found it in your book, a comedy magician and award-winning artist. So why, after all, you decided to work closely with the financial markets again?
Well, I was just taking a break, doing those other things. See, in the 1980s, I was very successful managing some hedge funds using traders like Paul Tudor Jones, Richard Dennis, John Henry, Monroe Trout, people like that. So I was able to semi-retire after that and just did some things that I wanted to do that I thought I'd enjoy doing, and for the challenge of it. I'm naturally an introverted person. So I thought if I could be a comedy magician, that would be something that would stretch my boundaries, you might say. And I was successful at it, as well as developing my own art techniques. I exhibited in art shows all across the country.
Wow, great. Great. Very interesting. Thank you for that. Your name became very hot in the industry once you started publishing your papers about momentum anomaly, and eventually your highly acclaimed book titled Dual Momentum Investing, an Innovative Strategy for Higher Returns with Lower Risk. And before we will dive into details on momentum anomaly, I'd like to discuss with you some more general topics related to modeling and different market approaches. Could you please give us a very short overview of modern finance, which you put in your book? Of course, we will not have time to discuss it in detail, everything, but you mentioned some theories and models like, for example, efficient market hypothesis or Markowitz mean variance optimization. Also, you mentioned about the capital asset pricing model and Black-Scholes option pricing. And you paid attention, Gary, to the fact that a healthy dose of
skepticism towards some, let's say, highly acclaimed experts is a good thing, especially when it comes to using such theories in our investment. Could you please explain why the academic world has apparently a problem, I don't know if it's a good word, when it comes to creating models which could be successfully applied?
Well, we could talk all day about that, but let me put it in a little historic context. Back in the 1950s or so, I think financial academics had physics envy. They wanted finance to be more of a science. So they came up with the random walk hypothesis, which said that even though stocks drift upward over time, after they did some simple runs analysis and simple serial correlation analysis, they declared the stock just fluctuate randomly otherwise. And that evolved into the efficient market hypothesis, which says that because people are rational, which is an important assumption, that if there were any abnormal profits to be had, people would quickly exploit them. They'd be arbitraged away. So the only thing that really makes sense is to buy and hold the market. Now, there's some problems with the efficient market hypothesis. While it's the general principles are good, and this is what academics are after. They're really after general principles. Someone once said, all models are wrong, but they can be useful nevertheless. So the principles behind efficient markets are good in that one should diversify, should keep your costs low, and that it's very difficult to beat the market. But it doesn't mean that it can't be done. Robert Shiller, who won a Nobel Prize in economics, said that efficient market is one of the most remarkable errors in the history of economic thought. And if you think about it, on a certain level, you have to think, how can markets be efficient if when events shift around prices so much, and it's hard to come up with a rational explanation for large price moves. Now, really, the idea behind modern finance has a lot of to do with Harry Markowitz's work on mean variance optimization. Before that, people didn't really understand what to do with respect to portfolio structuring, although they did know diversification was a good thing. So Markowitz put it all in a framework of mean variance optimization, where he took these principles out of business, which had to do with linear programming, and he changed it into quadratic programming because we're dealing with variance here. So what he said is, if you consider returns, correlations, and volatility, you put them all together, you can come up with the efficient portfolios, which are ones that will give you the highest expected return at any specified level of risk, or the lowest risk in terms of volatility at specific levels of return. So it's very elegant. And these academic models tend to be elegant. They tend to be equilibrium-based, which appeals to economists. The problem with them is that they're not that accurate. And that was the problem with mean variance optimization. The inputs are very unstable, especially the returns. And the errors are multiplicative because we're dealing with matrix inversions and squared terms in terms of variance. So it's very difficult to get anything stable out of it. And I tried back in the 1980s. I was one of the early people who actually tried to use mean variance optimization. And I ended up incorporating it to some extent, but I had to incorporate other things too, and kind of a Bayesian approach. So there have been people who tried to adjust it with resampling and other things, but it also was very cumbersome because, say you had thousands of securities and you were trying to construct a portfolio, especially back in the 1950s and 1960s, computers just didn't have the power to do these large-scale matrix inversions. So that's where the capital asset pricing model came in. And separate sets of researchers came to it together. separately. And what they did was they said, well, let's put everything in terms of the market and regress everything on the market, and then we'll get a beta and an alpha. The beta is how something moves in correspondence with the market, and the alpha is, you know, any excess return that you might get. And this became very big and very popular. The capital asset pricing model pretty much took over academic finance, and everything was stated in terms of beta. There were papers that would try to explain commodity prices in terms of beta to the S&P 500 index, which made no sense at all. And the problem with the capital asset pricing model is, as Fisher Black said, the theory is right, it just doesn't work. So what would happen is you'd get these high beta stocks or portfolios, and they wouldn't give as high a return as they were supposed to, and lower beta ones would give higher returns than they were supposed to. So people started to look at other ways of adjusting these things, and first they came up with extra market covariances, and finally they came up with factors, which are very popular right now, where they'll look at other things in addition to the market itself, things such as value, momentum, volatility, quality, size, and they'll factor these into their portfolio construct. Black-Scholes was another big development in finance. That was Fisher Black and Myron Scholes, who came up with an elegant way of pricing derivatives. And it involves some rocket science, Ito calculus, Bob Merton contributed. So it was very elegant. The problem with it, too, is it didn't work very well on the outliers, because it makes an assumption that stocks have a log normal distribution, and they don't. They tend to have a higher mean and a fatter tails than that. So out-of-money options were not being priced very well. So again, people had to go back to the drawing board and come up with other types of models, such as a binomial model. So all of these models are good in that they help explain market function and market behavior, but none of them are all that accurate in a real-world situation, including the area of factors that are very popular right now.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Gary. So we have to just remember that models are just models. I mean, they are kind of approximation to the world, so they never be perfect at all times. I mean, no model is completely true, right?
That's correct. Some are truer than others, but they pretty much all have limitations, and people sometimes don't realize that. They might say, okay, based on these assumptions, this is what we should be doing, and then they forget that they have assumptions, and that the world doesn't conform to those assumptions.
I understand. Maybe the practitioners are not focusing so much on being so elegant, but rather more are focusing on the practical side. Gary, could you please share with us an interesting story behind the first index fund at Smith, Barney & Company from 1976? That's a very interesting story, and I think it may be very interesting to most of the listeners of the podcast.
When I was at Smith Barney in 1976, they were a small investment banking firm. They decided to merge with Harris Upham in order to have a retail presence. And they held on to a few of the Harris Upham people in addition to the sales force. One of them was Bob Topol, who was one of the best OTC market makers in the world. And the markets were different back then. It wasn't electronic. So if you wanted to trade in an over-the-counter OTC stock, you had to call up different market makers and ask them what their bid-ask spreads were on the stocks you were interested in. And OTC market makers could do very well, not just from the size of the bid-ask spread, but based on their assessment of the stocks that they held in inventory, you know, how large an inventory they would have in each stock, long or sometimes short. So Bob Topol was a legend in the industry. He was one of the best. And he came around to our office after the merger and explained to us what he did and how we could utilize his service for our clients. And we were impressed, so we gave him some accolades. And when he was done talking, as kind of an aside, he just said, "Well, thank you very much, but do you want to hear about someone who does better than me? Someone who is actually the best trader that I've ever come across?" And so we said, "Sure." And he said, "Well, the person who does better than anyone else I know is actually my wife. Would you like to hear what she does?" And of course, we all sat back down and gave him our utmost attention. And he said, "My wife is very patriotic. So years ago, she bought all the stocks with United States in their name, like U.S. Steel." He went on and, you know, gave a whole list. And then all the stocks with American in their names, like American Cyanamid, American Telephone. And he, again, you know, a whole long list. And he said she did very, very well. So after a number of years, she bought all the generals, General Electric, General Motors, General Dynamics, et cetera. And everybody had a good laugh and went off to lunch. But I couldn't help but think about it. You know, I wondered, why is it that his wife did so well? And Bob was exposed to the best investors in the world, and he was saying that his wife did better than all of them. So I thought about it a while, and what I came up with was she did so well because, first of all, there was no turnover in her portfolio. Back then, commissions were high, so she didn't have to pay any commissions. She just bought and held a group of stocks. Secondly, there was no management fee to pay to anyone. Money managers and mutual funds, they, you know, your expenses might be 1% to 2% a year in terms of fees and other costs. And third, she was very well diversified. Back then, we would work on targeted portfolios for our clients. Aggressive ones would have glamour stocks. More conservative investors might have defensive type portfolios, and they would have certain biases in them. And hers was completely randomized because she picked stocks based on the letters of the alphabet. So in a sense, she created the first index fund, and she did very, very well that way.
Well, very interesting. Thank you for that, Gary. So now we know that passive investing using indexes gives us a huge chance to beat most of the actively managed mutual funds on the market. Although we haven't yet talked about momentum as such, I wanted to quickly ask you, why ETF based on momentum, that is implementing simple momentum strategies, still cannot beat the market? They are an index fund, but they, using a simple strategy, still have a problem to beat the market. And even in your book, you suggest to, if we want to mimic some momentum strategy using ETFs, you give a, let's say, better way to do it rather than using the smart beta ETFs.
Well, there's a problem with momentum that some people recognize and others dispute, and that has to do with the turnover. Momentum is a very active strategy. You might turn over 25% of your portfolio whenever you make an adjustment. And momentum portfolios, based on the theory behind it, do better when you rebalance frequently and when you have focused portfolios. So because momentum stocks tend to be volatile with wider bid-ask spreads than many other stocks, there's going to be some price impact because of that. And it's easy to tell what the top momentum stocks are. You can go onto the Alpha Architect website every month, and they have a list of the top 100 stocks based on 12-month momentum, skipping the last month. So now think about it a minute. Let's say you have billions of dollars, and they're all trying to trade in the same small number of stocks on a frequent basis. there's got to be some price impact. It's as if 20 people were trying to get through the door at the same time. There's going to be crowding going on. So academics who have studied what goes on with momentum have come up with some estimates, and some of them say that the momentum profits disappear because of that. Nobody knows for sure what's going on there, but that's their assessment. Others have said that it's because the momentum information is out there. Wang and Rubisam said that momentum profits have slowly disappeared since the early 1990s. And then in 2016, Bhattacharya, Lee, and Sonier had a paper in which they showed that momentum profits had become insignificant since the late 1990s. So stock momentum, as we know it today, was actually presented in a rigorous academic way in 1993 by Jagadish and Tittman. So one could also say that because this information is throughout the marketplace now, that that might have had some impact with respect to stock momentum.
Okay, I understand. Thank you for that, Gary. But do you think that we could have, for example, then an ETF implementing dual momentum?
We could. There isn't one yet, but there certainly could be. And in my opinion, there should be. There are a dozen or so momentum ETFs using individual stocks. Now, someone at Dimensional Fund Advisors recently showed the performance of those funds, and 10 out of the 11 funds have underperformed the market since their inception. The only one that's outperformed has the shortest track record of 5 or 6 years, and they've focused on mega cap growth stocks, which have done well during that time. So we'll have to wait and see what happens in the future.
Right, I understand. Thank you for that. We'll go into the more details of momentum, but just some more questions. Is value or buy and hold a robust driver from a perspective for achieving abnormal returns?
Value investing is what you're asking about?
Yes, yes.
Well, there's certainly been a lot of research done on it, and most of the research studies were positive initially, but not so much anymore. In 2012, Israel and Moskowitz from AQR did a paper in which they said the value premium is weak among the largest stocks. And then a couple of years later, Asnas Frazini, Israel and Moskowitz, came up with another paper in which they said the market-adjusted return to value within large cap is not different from zero. In other words, large cap funds haven't shown any kind of a momentum premium. Now, small caps, you get into a problem of price impact again, especially when you're dealing with micro caps. It's very difficult to trade those. Someone recently did some research showing that transaction costs of getting in and out micro caps can be 3 to 8% every time you make a trade. So makes it very challenging.
Okay, I understand. Thank you for that. So let's move to our key topic for this interview, momentum. And my first question, Gary, is could you please explain in simple words what momentum anomaly is, why it works, and what are the behavioral basis for momentum?
Well, momentum is persistence in performance. It means that something that has gone up in the past should continue to go up, or if it's been going down, it should continue to go down. Someone in Texas gave me this analogy. It's like riding a horse in the direction it's going, which makes things easier. Now, momentum was first uncovered in 1937 by Cowles and Jones, who tracked the performance of every NYSE stock from the 20s through the mid-30s, and they found that stocks that had performed well the prior year tended to continue performing well. And academics ignored that until 1990, 90s when Jagadish and Tipman performed a rigorous study showing pretty much the same thing, that momentum with stocks works when you're using a 3 to 12 month look back window or formation period. Now, the reason why it works is manyfold. The easiest explanation and probably the most logical one would be behavioral. And that has to do with the slow diffusion of information, people, and anchoring. These are behavioral aspects. People don't respond right away to information entering the marketplace. There's also the disposition effect, which causes people to take profits too soon and hold on to losers too long. So all of this creates a headwind for prices going to their fair value. But at some point, they have to catch up. And after they catch up, there are other behavioral factors that kick in, such as representativeness. When people see something happening, they assume it's going to continue. They tend to be myopic. So trends develop and people develop confidence and overconfidence, and those trends persist. And markets tend to perhaps overextend. So the overreaction is probably an even stronger aspect of momentum than the underreaction initially. What you need to understand is that although there are two types of momentum, relative and absolute, and people associate absolute momentum with trend, momentum is actually trend in all its aspects. With relative momentum, you're measuring a trend or relative strength of one item to another or to a group of others. And in absolute momentum, you're looking at trend or strength with respect to yourself over time. It's sometimes called time series momentum. But they're all dealing with serial correlation or trend.
Right, I understand. Thank you for that, Gary. By the way, even Professor Eugene Fama, creator of the efficient market hypothesis, accepts momentum as the premier anomaly for achieving high-risk adjusted returns. So for sure, there is something in it. But still, I mean, for years, for many decades in the 20th century, momentum anomaly was let's say, ignored by universities. My question, Gary, is because you mentioned already about two types of momentum, the relative, which is also, I found, having name cross-sectional, and absolute momentum, which is also called, I found, time series momentum. But I wanted to ask you why your absolute momentum approach is, for example, not based on also widely known and used moving averages, for example, 200 days moving average or 10 month moving average?
Well, it's similar. They're both do the same thing. They're both trend following. The 200 day moving average you have a problem with because you get a lot of whipsaws. You can go back and forth over that 200 day moving average quite frequently. So sometimes people will use a 10 month moving average instead. Zaka Mullen has done some research where he's compared different types of moving averages to absolute momentum. And he found only two were statistically significant. One was momentum, and the other was a reverse exponential moving average. And that the strongest of them was momentum.
By the way, because I want to be precise, as maybe someone is not so advanced, because I found absolute momentum at the beginning a bit misleading, because we look at an asset's excess return, but we also return less the return of on treasury bills. So basically, could we say that absolute momentum is roughly the same as relative momentum applied to an asset paired up with treasury bills? Because if we are comparing, you know what I mean?
Yes, the reason behind that is kind of rooted in the academic world, in which they say, well, during the whatever your formation period is, if you could have gotten a higher return just without bearing any risk, why would you not just stay there until you can show a higher return from your risky asset? So that's the reason behind it. It's it works both ways, whether you include the risk-free asset or not. It's just a little more appealing from a academic point of view to compare whatever asset you're looking at to a risk-free return.
Okay, thank you for that. How about adding stop losses to momentum?
You could do that. It doesn't really add much. I've looked at that. Stop losses used to be looked down upon in the academic world, but there has been some research showing that it can be useful. It used to be that the research would show, yes, it could limit your downside, but it would limit your upside too. And now if it's applied in a more sophisticated way, you might say, it can offer better risk-adjusted returns. But it's redundant when you're using absolute momentum, has been my experience. It doesn't really add any more than what absolute momentum provides.
Okay, I understand. Thank you for that, Gary. On which time frames momentum works best? I mean, is it monthly, or what is the time frame which momentum works best?
It depends on the asset, principally. But when you get into short time frames of a month or under, you're dealing with the opposite of momentum, which is mean reversion. So actually, the opposite occurs. So you might want to trade on an anti-momentum basis on a very short term. So the research on stocks have shown that momentum works over a 3 to 12 month formation period. 6 to 12 months is particularly strong. In fact, Tobias Moskowitz, one of the chief momentum researchers, has said momentum is a phenomenon that exists at 6 to 12 month horizons. Beyond 12 months, momentum wanes. Now, there are some people out there who have tried to extend momentum with stocks beyond 12 months or under 3 months. And in fact, there have been a couple of research efforts recently in which they've done that to try to make some points they wanted to make. But you're really looking outside the realm in which momentum has been shown to work with respect to stocks.
Okay, I understand. Thank you. How about including value, for example, price-to-book ratio into the momentum? Do you think, actually, I'm sure you know that, would that help to give to have a better result?
Well, you're dealing apples and oranges because when you're buying value stocks, you're usually buying stocks that are depressed, that have been going down in price or that are languishing. So it's unusual to find value stocks that are exhibiting momentum on a, especially on a 12-month basis, which is how momentum is usually used with respect to stocks. It's usually used 6 to 12 months for stocks or the stock market.
Right. I understand. Thank you. Before we will go into the details on dual momentum, I wanted to ask you about momentum and mean reversion. As we know, it's an opposite idea to momentum. So we say that if market goes up, it may go higher if we have momentum because of momentum. But on the other side, we say also that if something goes high, it will revert to the mean, it will go down. Could you please explain why these two opposite anomalies are valid and in which time frames they work? It may be misleading at some at first to some people, thinking that one anomaly cancels the other. But in fact, if they are working just in different time frames, this doesn't have to be the true. But could you please explain the differences here?
Sure. And what you say is correct. It depends on the time frames. Mean reversion would be 1 month or less, and this explains how stock specialists used to do so well, because they would go against public order flow on a short-term basis. Markets get short-term overextended. People tend to become over-optimistic or over-pessimistic, and then stocks will mean revert back to a fairer value. Mean reversion also works when you reach a 3 to 5 year horizon. So this might be the realm of value investing. Stocks that have been beaten down over the past 3 to 5 years, they tend to do a bit better going forward in time. Now, momentum is restricted to, or should be restricted to, the 3 to 12 month horizon if we're talking stocks. If we're talking other markets, this all changes. So, but if we're dealing with stocks or the stock market, we should be looking 3 to 12 months or 6 to 12 months, ideally, in terms of formation period for a momentum type investing.
Okay, thank you. So I think it's time to ask you probably the most important question of today's interview. You made a great contribution to the financial world by introducing so-called dual momentum, which combines both types of momentum. Could you please explain the dual momentum concept and how it can be applied?
Well, dual momentum is just taking relative strength momentum and absolute momentum and combining them together. The way we do that is, let's take relative momentum first. Now, my very first research paper in 2011, I looked at different ways of applying momentum. And I looked at individual stocks, I looked at industries, styles, geographic diversification. And what I found was that momentum gave the best results when it was applied to geographically diversified stock indices. Now, in 2015, Getsky and Samanoff came up with an academic paper showing the same thing. They used a broader test. They looked at individual stocks, commodities, currencies, bonds, and geographically diversified stock indices. And they found, again, that momentum gave the best results when it was applied to geographically diversified stock indices. So I knew that was the area I wanted to focus on. Now, there's 40-some different countries that you could trade that way, and you would get into a kind of a messy situation if you tried to do these countries individually, because many of them you couldn't even invest in, but the ones you could, you'd have liquidity problems or issues. You might have volatility issues. So I was considering, how could these be aggregated? Now, if you go and pick a subset, you might have selection bias if you just pick some of them. So I thought, well, is there some way to do this so it's all-inclusive? And fortunately, there's a very convenient way to do it, because the U.S. makes up about half of the world's stock market capitalization, and the rest of the world is the other half. So I said, okay, let's just apply relative momentum to U.S. stocks versus non-U.S. stocks. And there are large liquid ETFs for both of these. For U.S. stocks, I'm using the S&P 500 index. And for non-U.S. stocks, you could use one of the ETFs that's focused on the MSCI All Country World Index ex-U.S. or something comparable. So I said, okay, let's apply relative momentum to these two. And we'll go with whichever one has shown better performance over the preceding 12 months. And that will be our relative momentum selection.
Okay, I understand.
And that does quite well. We make over 2% more than we would get from just buying and holding a portfolio made up of these two by themselves. So, but the problem with relative momentum is you have the same downside that you have with the assets that make it up. So your drawdowns are equally as bad. Your volatility is equally as high. So I said, well, let's apply absolute momentum to this, because that's the real value of absolute momentum is how it can reduce your downside exposure during bear markets. So I said, let's key off of the S&P 500 index, because research has shown that U.S. stocks tend to lead the rest of the world. So let's say we apply absolute momentum to the S&P 500. And what we'll say is, if the S&P 500 index has gone up relative to T-bills over the past year, then we'll be in stocks. If the S&P 500 index has been down over the past year, then we'll go to the safety of intermediate term bonds. Because again, momentum is persistence in performance. So if stocks have been going up the past year, the odds are they'll continue to go up. And if they've gone down over the past year, they should continue to go down. So the way I actually apply it is I look at the S&P 500 first, and I say, has the S&P 500 gone up or down over the past year? If it's gone down, then I'll go into an ETF for aggregate bonds, which is investment grade, high quality, widely diversified portfolio of intermediate term bonds. And if the S&P 500 index has gone up and absolute momentum is positive, then I'll apply relative momentum to the S&P 500 index and the All Country World Index. And whichever one of the two has done better over the past 12 months, that's the one I'll invest in until that situation changes. And I check that every month. So there's monthly rebalancing. There's not a lot of trading. There's about 1.4 trades per year. So we don't have to worry about price impact or crowding. ETFs for these are enormous. There's no problem in terms of liquidity or market impact.
Okay, thank you for that, Gary. And you call this strategy Global Equity Momentum, GEM. I just wanted to ask you some basic statistics behind this strategy. What I'm in terms of maximum drawdown, standard deviation, or skewness, or left tail risk, profit. Mm-hmm. How does it look? Because as you said that when we apply only relative momentum, then basically there's not so much improvement, but the absolute momentum is a big game changer, so to speak.
Yes. Well, they both are game changers. Some people might not appreciate that, but they're both quite important. And as far as the numbers go, going back to 1950 on my GEM model, the compound annual growth rate is 15.8%. The standard deviation is 11.5. The maximum drawdown, 18%. And you were asking what else? The skew, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah, that was skewness. Minus 0.12. In contrast, the S&P 500 skew is minus 0.43, and the global asset allocation benchmark is minus 0.54. So it does a good job of dealing with left tail risk.
Right, I understand. By the way, there are, as far as I understood, two ways of applying momentum in a GEM model. I mean, in the first approach, you apply the absolute momentum on S&P 500, but in the second approach, what you talked about before, we apply, as the first step, we apply the relative momentum, and then basically you go further from that. But why I'm asking this is because we can choose whichever approach we would like to use in our trading, right? But
yes,
as far as I understand, you prefer to use first to use the absolute momentum on S&P 500 to see if the trend on the stock market is in uptrend.
Yes, I do. There's a paper by Rapash. It's there's a reference to it in my book and on my blog, in which they show that U.S. stocks tend to be a leading indicator of what's happening with respect to world economy and global stocks. So I prefer to key off of that, but they both give good results. Applying absolute momentum first gives slightly better results, but that's not the main reason why I do it. I do it because I think it makes more sense.
Right. But we can have a situation in which, for example, the rest of the world is in the uptrend, but we would hold bonds in our portfolio because the S&P would be in downtrend. This is possible, I mean, at least in theory.
In theory, it's possible. That situation doesn't last very long. It usually resolves itself one way or the other. So like I say, that's why I presented both ways in my book, so people can choose whichever they prefer.
I understand. What are the main advantages of dual momentum? I mean, I'm asking in terms of scalability or volatility. We already said a bit about this, or the costs. You said that there are not too many transactions. And also what is very important, at least from my point of view, but I'm a software engineer, so to me it's pretty important, it's a disciplined approach. It's a rule-based approach. How do you see the main advantages of dual momentum?
Well, that's a good point. Any rules-based approach is worthwhile looking at because it takes a lot of the anxiety and guesswork out of making an investment decision. So then what you need is a discipline to stick with it. And that can sometimes be challenging. Every time you deviate from the market portfolio, there's a potential to have your portfolio underperform. And that happens with dual momentum as well as anything else. We will have times when we underperform our benchmark. We'll have times when there are whipsaws. And people tend to sometimes get emotionally caught up in those things and lose sight of the big picture. There have been some blog posts recently trying to take advantage of that, exploit that behavioral weakness among people by presenting them with alternative scenarios. But it's important. So it's important to understand, have a good understanding of what you're doing and why you're doing it, and then to have confidence in it. Over the long run. Keep in mind that GEM, as presented in my book, the Sharpe ratio is 0.96. You know, and you compare that to global asset allocation of 0.57. You know, there's reasons why you want to give it some serious consideration and try to understand it as best you can.
Right, I understand. But do you think that the short-term volatility, which of course is in long-term approach as dual momentum, do you think that this is the biggest issue for being disciplined for while following such strategy? Because people are too much focused on the very short period of time. They don't see the longer term.
That's part of it. Another part of it is sometimes people are just a bit fickle and they're always looking for something new, something different. And they tend to forget the salient features of what they're with. So that's why I encourage people to reread my book, especially Chapter 8, to read my blog posts, to read the research that's out there, so that they continue to have understanding and appreciation for what's going on. You look at professions and there's continuing education in a lot of them. I think it's necessary that people remind themselves of why they were interested in something in the first place, and so that they don't lose sight of the principles and the desirable features.
Right. The GEM is very simple and very effective, but this is also, I know this from being a software engineer also, people sometimes believe more in something complex because they think if there are more moving parts, it's, you know, it's more reliable. But it's the opposite, actually, that if something works and it's simple, then it's more reliable. But we as people, we have a, you know, different nature.
That's a very good point. And you should realize the importance of what you just said. Everyone should realize that, because not only is complicated not something you should be attracted to, but you should be very cautious when something is complicated. Because whenever you have more moving parts, you have more danger of overfitting, of overspecification, and we see that all the time in research. There have been studies done in the academic side with respect to factors, for example, where many of them don't do as well out of sample, real time, as opposed to when they were first developed. And that has a lot to do with the fact that these models may have been overspecified or put together in such a way that they basically were designed to conform to the data.
Right. Thank you for that, Gary. I found on your blog a note about dollar cost averaging, DCA, used with dual momentum. And my question is, have you maybe analyzed another case where we would be adding new capital to our portfolio, but not per DCA strategy, but when it's in a drawdown? So basically a kind of equity line trading. So let's say that on a regular basis, we are going to add extra capital to our portfolio, but instead of doing that every month or so, we will do it when we are in drawdown, let's say, at a certain level.
That's a good idea. Most people have a problem with that psychologically. They tend to want to do the opposite. And in fact, going back all my years from running hedge funds to managing accounts to putting together models, the one thing I can say with certainty, and I can't say pretty much anything else with certainty, but the one thing I can say with pretty much certainty is that when people withdraw, when they pull money away from a program, it almost invariably does well after that. So that's my top indicator for good performance going forward, is when blood is running in the streets, you might say. That's when they say the best time to invest is. And that's true. And when you think about it, it makes sense, because those who have sold, who are going to sell, you know, that's when they do it. And then the only people left around are buyers who have some modicum of intelligence, who recognize that opportunities lie ahead.
Right. I had on my podcast Tom Basso. He's also a trend follower, and he supports that idea of adding more money to your portfolio if you are in drawdown. But as you said, people tend to do the opposite, and that's why maybe the markets are inefficient, by the way. I have another question to you, Gary, about the fact that the GEM, or the dual momentum, is publicly known. Do you think that because dual momentum is investing in a very broad market like S&P 500 or rest of the world, it is much less prone to that it will stop working in the future because so many people will start using it? Because if we would use it on the, if we would apply it to individual stocks, of course, we will have quickly problems, especially if someone has a bigger capital. But here we are investing in the broadest market. So do you think that still there is a risk that it may stop working or it will not be so efficient in the future?
Well, there's that risk with every investment, but I think it's not so high with dual momentum the way I use it. For one reason is, as you say, these these markets are enormous. You can go into the S&P 500 index with billions at a time and have no impact, and the same with the rest of the world or aggregate bonds. But the other reason is behavioral. Dual momentum is not as popular as one might think. There are, as you pointed out, there are no dual momentum ETFs now. I have some proprietary models, which I license to investment advisors, and the amount of capital being managed there, while it's nice, you know, it's not very large compared to other investment programs out there. I think that people have trouble getting their heads around this. One reason might be that it's dual. It involves a couple of different concepts that people have to understand and appreciate. And the other just has to do with it being something different than what people are used to.
Right, I understand. Thank you for that, Gary. By the way, you mentioned about proprietary strategies. So Who's the target for these strategies? Is it developed for mostly institutions, or it could be also used by a retail trader? Because the GEM model is very simple, and I see the big value in it because it's very simple. You can spend just a few minutes a month basically on it, and that's it. And you don't have to really dedicate more time on it.
Yes, the GEM was developed that way. I wanted something that I could put in a book that I could give to the public so they could take advantage of this simply, easily, without expending too much time or energy. And that was relatively tax efficient because there's only 1.4 trades per year. Most of our gains, 70% of the gains, in fact, tend to be long-term capital gains. And most of the losses tend to be short-term. So it's tax efficient. Now, in the proprietary models, those are targeted towards wealthy individuals or institutional investors sometimes. And there's more that goes into them. We try to be more adaptive to market conditions. We use different look-back periods in an intelligent way, not just randomly. We applied dual momentum to the fixed income market as well as to the stock markets. And there's some nuances that go into those models.
Okay, I understand. But you prefer to license them rather than run, for example, your own hedge fund?
I've had hedge funds before in the past. I'm 69 years old. I don't really want to get into all the administrative side of things anymore. And I prefer doing research and writing and having time for other things. So I think it's a good partnership. I can license to a few investment advisors who understand and appreciate what I do. They can handle administration and marketing, and I could spend my time doing what I think I'm best at.
I would like to talk a bit about the backtesting momentum or dual momentum. How should we approach the model backtesting to avoid problems with the care fitting, data snooping, or selection bias? Because as there is a saying that if you torture your data long enough, it will confess to anything. But how you approach to backtesting so that you are sure that it's done correctly?
That's an excellent question. I don't think it gets asked enough. The first thing is to make sure there's a logical basis for it, that theory supports it. And that's the nice thing about momentum, is that there are explanations for why it works. And academic papers, you usually see that. They don't just deal with empirical data. They want to know why something works. So that's the main thing. If you're just going out there blindly mining data, you're going to come up with results that look attractive, no doubt about it, but many times those will be spurious results. The other thing is to make sure there's validation out of sample. So that's the nice thing about both types of momentum. Academics keep going further and further back in time. It started out, you know, using just a 10-year period in the 1930s when Cowles and Jones did their work. And then with Jagadish and Tishman, they had a data set from the 60s through the 80s. And then it's gradually been taken further and further back. Getsky and Samanov have tested both types of momentum back to the year 1801. And they found that it's consistent and robust and works across different markets. So that's another thing you look at, is how consistent is it? Does it work in other markets? Are the parameters stable? There's a whole lot of things that you should consider. And as I mentioned earlier, Grazerman took the basically a 12-month trend type momentum all the way back as far as he could, almost to the time of Genesis. So those are the kinds of things you look at. You don't just go and play around with the data, especially limited amount of data.
Okay, I understand. But are you dividing your data into in-sample set and out-of-sample? for verification, or you know that you have some kind of verification because, like, for example, there were some researches done in the before the Second World War, and it worked till nowadays, then you know that this is basically out of sample. So you're not doing any magic on the data that you split for in sample, out of sample.
That can be deceiving. People, you know, sometimes say, well, I held out data. But what happens if that holdout data doesn't work? You know, what do you do? Some people will just tweak their model and try it again.
Right.
Do they really go on to something else entirely? There's no way of knowing. So when I first developed the GEM model, the dual momentum, I was using data from 1975 through, I believe, 2012. And since then, I've been able to get data going further back in time. I started now in 1950. So, well, the first incremental edition of data I got took me to 1970. And so I had that bear market, and it held up really well during that time. And then I was able to get more data, which I took back to 1950. And it's done fine, both in sample and out of sample. But more importantly, we have all these other out-of-sample tests that have been going on ever since the seminal momentum paper came out in 1993.
Okay, I understand. Yes, I think also that still using in-sample, out-of-sample, we still can be in the pitfall of curve fitting. Therefore, for example, a kind of randomized out-of-sample test may be more useful. Do you agree with such a statement?
It depends. It's better to just have the actual data and to have actual out-of-sample data. When you try to randomize things, you're not always going to get them to conform to the way that the markets are. The markets tend to be stochastic in nature. There's non-constant variance. You have regime shifts over time that are quite different. So it's always better to have real data than to try to do some type of resampling.
I understand. Gary, I wanted to ask you about the 12-month look-back period. I know that there is a big history behind it, so it's not like out of the blue 12 months. It has the good reason to be 12 months. But I wanted to ask you a question. Does it still make any sense to try at least periodically reoptimize this parameter so that strategy could, let's say, adapt to market changes? Or do you think it's not a good way to go?
Well, because there's a lot of data to validate this, you would need a lot of data to unvalidate it, let's say, too. So
right.
I don't think that is something that one should be focusing on. Now, there's nothing holy about a 12-month look back. Like I mentioned, there are ways to use other look backs, but not just randomly pick different monthly periods. I have a more intelligent way to select look back periods. That's part of my proprietary models. So I can't discuss them in detail, but 12-month look back is still a very useful one. And it's held up well back to the 1200s. So I don't think people can really say that it's just a lucky guess that you're going with 12 months.
Yeah, thank you, Gary. I found, for example, that I had Perry Kaufman on my show some months ago, and he was mentioning about the percentage-spaced test values. So, for example, in GEM, we could have, let's say, 3, 6, 12 months look back period. Do you think that such approach indeed in terms of GEM could be applicable?
Yes, I'm familiar with, I know Perry, I'm familiar with his work. Now, he made a good point in that if you equally space your look back periods, you're going to favor a certain area because, you know, because of the way that the time thing works. So there's some drawbacks to doing that. And that's one of the reasons why I don't do it. I think there are more intelligent ways to select your look back periods.
Right. I understand. By the way, what tools software or programming languages, Gary, do you use when you create and test your models?
I use Excel to a great extent. It's done everything I need to do. Occasionally, I'll use R or Python for some specific purpose. But you can do all of this in Excel.
Right, of course. And as for the data, because this is the business where we are really data hungry, so to speak. So do you have any special source of data so that you could go back to 1950? Is it publicly available?
If you've got plenty of money to spend, it is. That's the problem with the data. It used to be if you asked S&P nicely, they would give you their data. They don't do that anymore. The MSCI data is available to the public. If you have the right link, you can get it back to the 1970s. Bond data is problematic. So fortunately, some of the advisors I work with have access to this data, and they make it available to me going back pretty much as far as I need.
Okay, I understand. We talked already about that people tend to focus too much on the short-term volatility, but at the end of 2018, let's say it was tough for GEM strategy, which is absolutely normal, but then we saw some comments on the internet, people commenting, is it working or not? And I wanted to use this as a trigger to some discussion about how difficult, in fact, is to follow a strategy, even if it has a very good track record, but which enters a worst period having bad performance. Why do you think people have a problem to follow the rule-based strategy, even if they are so well, let's say, educated in that? Because I will talk about, for example, a guy, Corey Hofsten from Newfound Research, who's a very well educated guy in that area. Or also I found Michael Harris on the Price Action Lab, who said that GEM is based on the hindsight and some optimization and also wishful thinking. So, I mean, I appreciate your research effort, Gary, and I don't know of anyone doing his homework so well as you did, but could you please comment these critical comments against GEM?
Well, Corey's comment was based on a small amount of research he did over a 10-year period. He looked at using every look back from 6 to 12 months, so there's 7 of them, and he said that they're statistically equivalent. But you can't really do that using just 10 years of data and get anything meaningful, especially when these lookbacks are correlated to one another. But his point on saying that was that you end up with specification risk by going with just one lookback. However, as I show in the blog post I came up with as a response, there isn't that much difference in terms of the results, whether you go with 12 months, which has been shown to work effectively, or some combination. Now, there are other ways of dealing with specification risk too, than just changing your look-back period. You may not want to change your look-back period, let's say if you're someone who just bought my book and want a simple way to implement it without having to use 7 different look-back periods. Corey also says you should use different time periods as well. So if you were doing it every week instead of every month with 7 look-backs, you have 28 different models. Well, I don't know how too many people who are going to want to run 28 different models. And if you did, your tax benefits would most likely not be there anymore. So another way to deal with specification risk is just to put other assets into your portfolio. And not only does that get rid of specification risk, but it gets rid of model risk as well, because you're diversified in the sense of what you're doing and not just in how you're doing it. As far as Michael Harris's blog post, I just don't understand what he's getting at there. I don't think he does either. He was saying that Jim has the dual momentum approach I'm taking is not doing well now because of a market impact from large funds doing it. Well, there are no ETFs, there are no funds that I know of who are using dual momentum. Furthermore, Harris took a range of lookbacks from 1 to 24 months over a 10-year window, and he said, okay, the far ends, like below 3 months and over 12 months, they had large drawdowns. Well, that's garbage in, garbage out. There's no way anyone who has studied momentum research would use, you know, lookbacks that short, and especially lookbacks that long, and try to draw any kind of meaningful conclusions. And looking at anything over just a 10-year window is not good research either. And then he made a statement that GEM outperforms on a risk-adjusted basis only in the limited time period presented. And he showed was a 10-year period. So he didn't show anything to support what he was saying, and it's not true what he said anyway.
Thank you for that, Gary, for that explanation. By the way, I found funny on your blog, you showed your coffee mug in your office where you have a label saying even dead cats bounce, which reminds you about short-term mean reversion. Because I see that people are very interested about, you know, we have some pundits, so to speak, saying that the strategy doesn't work because it's in the period of worse performance, which is natural. But if it's performing very well, we cannot find them. So this is just my small comment on that.
Well, there's no worse performance here at all.
Yeah, you know, it's normal.
Yeah, it's we had a whipsaw the end of last year, and we missed out on a month of profit in the S&P.
And if you look on the table where you see the history from the 50s till nowadays, it's absolutely normal to what we saw in the past. There's nothing exceptional. So I'm not involved in that emotionally. I don't put any money there, but I see I cannot find any issue there. Okay. By the way, if we are talking about the risk, would you suggest anyone interested in using any strategy to do risk tolerance assessment, which can show us if our financial objectives are too conservative or maybe they are too aggressive?
That's always a good idea. You want to find an investment that suits you financially and emotionally. The best investment is the one that you're going to stick with. So if a certain investment is too volatile, you can reduce the volatility by adding more stable assets to it. In terms of my proprietary models, I have three of them. I have an enhanced version of the global equities momentum, as we've been talking about. I have a global balanced momentum, an enhanced version of that, that has a 30% fixed allocation to bonds that are managed according to dual momentum. And I have a global conservative momentum, which has an even higher proportion of fixed income.
Okay, thank you for that, Gary. Do you think that an average investor, trader, may compete with professionals like hedge funds, or is it worth to do so, in your opinion?
Yes, hedge funds are nothing remarkable, especially now. It used to be that some of the best traders started hedge funds because they wanted to participate in profits. But over the last 20 years, anyone and his brother can start a hedge fund, and many of them have. And just because something is a hedge fund doesn't mean that it's better than anything else. The data shows that to be true. And not that many of them hedge anymore either. So I think something like dual momentum people can do, whereas an institutional investor, hedge fund or not, might be more reluctant to because of career risk. Anytime you deviate from what other people are doing, you run the risk of being fired if you underperform. You can be wrong as long as everybody else is wrong. But if you're wrong when everybody else is right, there's a very good chance you're going to lose your job. So individual investors don't have to worry about that. What they have to worry about is psychologically firing themselves by abandoning a program if it has a period of underperformance.
I understand. By the way, I read in your book that you were in the army, you were a Vietnam vet. And do you think that your military background drives certain character traits that are useful in investing world? Do you think that this kind of experience is helpful to be more disciplined?
I think so. I think being disciplined is essential when you're following a rule-based strategy. Being able to follow orders, which is the orders of the model, not abandoning your post. That's the first thing we learned in the military until properly relieved. So unless something better comes along, this is what I'm going with.
Right, I understand. We are slowly reaching to the end of this interview, but I have a few more questions. And I wanted to ask you about, because we were talking about the long-term trading approach, how about some short-term trading strategies, short-term approach? Do you prefer long-term? Is there a specific reason why you just focus on long-term?
Well, it's easier long-term. The markets, what I want to do is be in tune with the markets. And momentum works, you know, using a 6 to 12 month look back primarily. And that's a slower moving approach. You don't get involved in so much chop in terms of the market. Occasionally, you'll get a whipsaw. You'll get periods of underperformance. But the advantage of what I do is that we sidestep bear markets for the most part. And because of relative momentum, we're able to pick up extra return by switching between U.S. and non-U.S. stocks. Now, that's not to say that there people can't make money with shorter-term trading. In fact, I've been working on some shorter-term models across different markets now. And but you have to be more involved. You can't just look at those once a month or twice a month like we do right. with proprietary models. Only have to dial those up twice a month. But for shorter-term models, I have to look at what's going on every day. So people who want to make that kind of commitment, there's certainly profits to be had there too.
Right. But of course, especially from the point of view of a retail trader, long-term approach is easier in terms of execution as well. As you said, we can just do it once a month, for example, in comparison to do it daily.
Well, studies have shown that one of the disadvantages that retail traders have is that they tend to overtrade, and that works against them.
Right, right. So when I was reading your materials on the blog and your book, I was really impressed by the amount of the information I could find there. And just out of curiosity, was it just you writing all this, creating all this, or you have some people helping you as well? Because it's just incredible how many information you put there. It's just amazing.
Well, thank you. I read a lot. I think continuing education is really useful. Nobody has all the answers to everything. I'm always trying to learn and grow as a investor, a model builder, and individual. So it's important to try to keep an open mind and be humble. Markets will teach you humility, if nothing else.
Right, right. I understand. Thank you for that. Gary, before we finish today, is there anything you would like to add? Any extra comments or anything you would like to add I haven't asked you, maybe?
Well, I think it's important for people to follow this precepts. And I've heard them used in other areas, not just in investing. But what you want to do is investigate carefully. You know, look at all the information, choose wisely, and follow faithfully.
Right. Very interesting. Okay, thank you for that. If someone would like to contact you, what's the best way to do it, Gary?
You can do it through my website or blog. There's links there for sending me emails. My website is optimalmomentum.net, and my blog is dualmomentum.com.
Okay, I will put all the details on my website under this episode, so everyone will can find it there. Gary, I'm very grateful for your time and effort. I appreciate it very much. My apologies for waking you up early in the morning today, as it was pretty early in California when we started this podcast. I'm absolutely sure that by covering so much ground in this interview, many listeners will be inspired to do further research and further reading, as it's really worthwhile to do it. And I'm very, very grateful for your time you spent with us today here.
My pleasure, and thank you for your insightful questions. I think this is one of the best interviews I've ever had.
Huh, thank you for that. Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.